recording. From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe, Past and Present. I'm Holly Case of the History Department at Cornell, and occasionally we invite visitors to our campus to present their work on East Central Europe and interact with students. This blog series will bring you their views on the past, present, and future of the region and how scholars approach it. So today I'm talking with Alison Frank, a young professor of, among other things, Central European history at Harvard University and a great colleague and friend. Professor Frank is the author of a number of articles and an excellent book on the oil industry in the Habsburg monarchy entitled Oil Empire, Visions of Prosperity in Austrian Galicia. And she's now working on a project on the coastline of Austria-Hungary in the port city of Trieste. So, Alison, one thing that's that I find so striking about your research is how refreshingly original it is. And I wanted you to tell us a bit about how you chose your research topic for the book and how you choose research topics in general.
Well, the short answer, Holly, is that I start with questions that I can't answer. So, just something that I don't know much about, rather than something that I know, that I feel that I understand, but the understanding may be wrong or that it could be improved. So I actually like to start with things that are completely unfamiliar to me, which means I have a long way to go before I can say anything interesting about them, but it also means that I'm really able to sustain interest in those topics for a long time because the learning curve is so steep. So in the case of the book on the oil industry, I stumbled across a reference to oil in Galicia in a poem by Ivan Franco that I was reading in the summer after my second year of graduate school. And I didn't really pay attention to it. And then coincidentally, the next thing I chose to read was The Man Without Qualities by Robert Musil. And there's a very, as far as the plot of the novel goes, insignificant subplot involving a military man's interest in trading access to the Galician oil fields to a Prussian entrepreneur in exchange for, money, more or less. And so that was the second oblique reference to oil in Galicia that I came across accidentally in two pieces of literature. And then I wondered if there actually was oil in Galicia. And the fact that I didn't know the answer to that question made me very curious indeed when I found out that that Galicia was the third largest producer of oil in the world in 1909. So I took the fact that I didn't know that I had never heard anything about it, as an indication that it hadn't really been taken into consideration the way that people write Galician history. And as I was doing research for the book, and in fairness to the scholars that go before me, I did find a few references to the oil industry, passing references usually, that I just had completely neglected before. Things like Galicia was an entirely agricultural province, comma, except for its oil industry, comma, and then on we go with the agricultural province story. So I was very curious about that. What made me really want to write a book about it was that it fit in with my general desire to find ways of organizing book projects that were not in their essence about national identity, which doesn't mean that I don't think that national identity is important, but rather that I was looking for some other organizing principle beyond the place where this nationality lived or which nationalities lived in this political, in this space defined by a political border. So oil did that, and that's why I stuck with it. Sort of the same thing, in a sense. A couple things came together. I discovered that the name I kept coming across in the research for the first book, every once in a while I'd come across references to the Austrian Lloyd, which I assumed was an insurance company that was a subsidiary of Lloyd's of London. And at some point realized that that isn't true, that the Austrian Lloyd had nothing to do with Lloyd's of London and that it wasn't a insurance company. And I was curious about that, but I didn't bother in my unsurpassed laziness to figure out why, what it was, or why it was called Lloyd. You know, it seemed very strange to me, but I sort of tucked that away into the back of my head. And then when I was trying to think about something else to do, and I knew I didn't want to write another book about Galicia right after the first one, I thought about other parts of the Habsburg Empire that I felt were relatively neglected. So we have a lot of exceptionally good historians working on Vienna, and a lot of exceptionally good historians working on Bohemia and Hungary. But I didn't feel like there were as many people that were interested in parts of the empire that didn't really fit into its core. So these, you know, real peripheries like Galicia, or for that matter, Trieste, and the other end, the other side. And I wondered what I would have to rethink about Austria-Hungary, if anything, if I paid more attention to the fact that it had a major port on the Mediterranean, that it was, in addition to being a Central European power, that it was also a Mediterranean power, whether that was even true and what it meant. In the same way that when I was thinking about the Galician oil industry, part of what I was trying to understand is, well, is Galicia really an agricultural province and there happens to be oil there, but it doesn't matter, or is it, I imagine that there'd be, I should note, that the extraction of oil itself is not so industrial, right? The refining of oil requires factories and technology. The extraction of oil can proceed alongside agriculture. Doesn't really need to fundamentally change the shape of the province. But I didn't know that. So the same thing with Trieste. I wondered. I didn't know that we have it all wrong about the Austrian Empire, because really it's a maritime empire. But I wondered if the fact that it had this Mediterranean port meant there was a part of the story that was neglected. So I wanted to, and I'm still answering that question. The book's not done.
It's an excellent question. We look forward to hearing more about the answer. I'd just like to ask, you know, along these lines, to think back a bit. What aspects would you say of your training as an historian did you find most useful? And what, in addition to that, do you try to offer other students, or do you think other students entering the field should be offered in terms of training? I mean, and this might go to the very question of how you define the field and what you consider significant about it. But just in general, what was useful to you, and what do you seek to give to the next generation of scholars?
Well, I really benefited from the fact that my PhD program operated on a committee system, so that although all students in our system were assigned an advisor, we were really expected to consult a committee of professors who would help frame our dissertations. And there wasn't anyone who worked on Galicia or on Austria-Hungary at my university. So I worked with David Blackburn, who is an expert on German history, and Roman Sporluk, who's an expert on Ukrainian history, and the area that I was interested in fell sort of between the two. And that turned out to be a real advantage for me, because I was constantly working to think about the way, I had a space, in a sense, to figure out how I could approach the writing of history like them, without that meaning I was going to reproduce what they were doing, sort of be a junior varsity version of these serious scholars who were training me, because neither of them was really an expert on the Austrian Empire. So I spent a lot of time thinking about David Blackburn's methodological approach, Roman Sporluk's methodological approach. They don't perfectly complement one another, so that also gave me some space to take to learn from each of them, and then to apply it in a way that felt like it was mine rather than something that had been handed down to me by a gifted mentor, sort of an amalgam of things handed down by two gifted mentors. And I think that is something that it is important for graduate students to have also. So to have it's great to be at a university where you have a professor who works in your field, but that shouldn't stop you from finding somebody who doesn't work in your field, who writes in a way that you think is really exciting, or who frames questions in a way that you think is really useful. And to try to prove to that person that what you're doing is interesting to them is a great test of whether or not it has resonance outside of your most immediate field, whether you are thinking in ways that are methodologically innovative, whether you are answering questions that are going to interest people that don't just want to know everything about the place that you're writing about. So I think that that the more we as scholars take interest in one another's students or work together to train students, and the more students are able to call on multiple people, which is obviously easier where departments are larger, but I think is possible anywhere, you know, the better off those students will be. The other thing that students in our area really need is a lot of support in learning languages. And I think it's really important for students not to be overly intimidated if they don't know, if they do not command a language that is necessary to properly answer the question that interests them. So I would rather a student learned a new language in order to stick with a really great question than change the question so that learning that language wasn't necessary, if that makes any sense. And that means I think it's really important that we as historians pay attention not only to the vitality of history departments that we work in, but also of the language departments at our universities, that we should be boosters of language programs because our students can't survive without healthy language programs.
So when you were talking about sources of inspiration, I wondered whether there has been a book that you've read in the course of your academic career, even prior to that, that has really inspired you, something that has set you off thinking in a different way, or or maybe not, it doesn't even have to be a book, or a source that really got you thinking about something, or just the romance of text. Share.
The romance of text. Oh, Holly, you're taking me in the wrong direction. So, this is going to be somewhat embarrassing because as soon as I mention how moved I was by this book, then anyone who has read it will wonder why my book is not better. But I was really, really inspired by Richard White's Organic Machine. I'm not a genuine environmental historian. I don't know much about ecology. But thinking about the way that he connected economic practice and social behavior and the environment was really moving to me. And part of what I hoped to do in Oil Empire was to make it impossible to think about historical action or change without thinking about the place in which this action occurs, or about the give and take between human beings and our environment, or about rivers and plants and land and dirt and air and all the things that surround us. So that was it's also a beautifully written book. So I really enjoyed that one. But you know, I can't say that I am an heir, you know, that my book is somehow moves the legacy of that book forward. But I recommend that anybody who has any even moderate interest in environmental history read the book. Another example that I read recently, so long after I picked my dissertation topic, of a book that I think works very well and is very useful methodologically, is David Blackburn's Conquest of Nature, about the role of water in changing not only the German landscape, but German history. So.
Thanks. That was sort of a cheap trick on my part, you know, to get some good book recommendations. this is more a question about our field, and we've sort of tangentially touched on the issue of what that is, and maybe we should steer clear of that, because it's sort of a pit, but one thing that I've oftentimes thought is that area studies can behave like a ghetto. It's a nice ghetto, but a ghetto nonetheless, that has in some respects prevented us from thinking broadly about the problems and questions we encounter in our research. And at other times, when I think about area studies, I think, oh, it's so sad that area studies is in decline, because it means that, we'll have fewer resources. And you mentioned languages as one for our grad students and for other people coming up in the field, and less interest among talented young people in the field. And then, you know, I love to be at the area studies conference, the AAASS, and reconnect with people and being among people who, to whom you don't have to explain everything before you start with the interesting stuff. So I'd basically like to ask you how you see area studies and whether, like what aspects of it you think are valuable, which aspects you think we need to work to keep, and which ones can we let go as being unproductive, or what kinds of institutional structures would serve us the best, or would serve you the best, and the future generations.
Yeah, this is sort of a tough one for me, Holly, and I think I haven't thought about it as much as you have. But I do believe that unless we are all going to become comparativists all the time, that whether or not we want to call it area studies, some institutional grounding that provides us with a deep knowledge of a region is necessary before we can contribute anything to, you know, before we can do transnational or international history, before I can connect with a historian of the American South or of the British Empire or of South Africa and realize that we're both interested in questions of sovereignty, or both interested in questions of property rights, and that there are interesting parallels. I have to understand sovereignty and property rights in the part of the world that I know something about, right? And the less familiar that part of the world is to me coming out of high school, the more important it is that I can get my university, my college, my graduate program, my undergraduate program can help me come to understand that part of the world. And that means engaging with the literature and learning the languages and learning something about the history. And if I'm interested in more contemporary issues, understanding the political landscape. And that is hard work. And we don't get it through osmosis unless we're Americanists. And even then, we may not get it sufficiently growing up. So there has to be a place where you can go and get those resources. And in that sense, I think that eliminating area studies centers or programs is, you know, dangerous, sounds so conspiratorial and pessimistic, but it is, we need to make sure that we do provide that we can provide students with deep familiarity of places in which they did not grow up, of places that are unfamiliar to them. You know, I mean, I think the world would be a better place if we knew a lot more about a wider range of different places outside of the United States. That being said, for us as professional historians who are not connected with universities only in order to continue our own education, but also in order to provide, to help educate others, right? We shouldn't stay within the area studies bubble, but should strive to do that work I was talking about before, to take what we know about, in our case, East Central Europe, and figure out how and why it is relevant to people who are not actually very interested in East Central Europe, but are interested in questions about the role of women in society, or in questions about the relationship between humans and the environment, or in questions about sovereignty, or citizenship, or rights, or enslavement and servitude, or the relationship between capitalism and environmental, you know, degradation or environmental protection. Any number of things that can connect us to people who share our interests outside of the field also. But I'm trying to have my cake and eat it too. I don't think that we should abandon the deep knowledge that we acquire of a part of the world just because we recognize that some of the most interesting questions that we can answer are transnational questions or international questions that are going to pull us not only in our region, everything in a sense is transnational and international, but are even going to pull us out of the region.
So, one of the best conferences, the most enjoyable and most interesting that I've ever attended, was organized by you and Tara Zahra, and it was a few years ago at Harvard, and the topic, as I recall, was internationalizing the history of East Central Europe. Is that right? I've always wanted to ask you what your motivations were for organizing that particular conference, and what more do you think can be done in order to, quote unquote, internationalize the region's history?
Well, I think Tara and I were basically trying to do something along the lines of what I was describing in my answer to your last question, and that is to have a conversation with other people who are, you know, experts in this field, who study East Central Europe, but are thinking about questions that expand beyond the boundaries of the field, and to bring them together and to see the different ways in which we are going about this project. I think the next step would be to have a conference like that that also included people who are not East Central Europeanists. So that's the obvious next step, because one of the things that we were doing is talking about the ways that Eastern Europe is not exceptional. But we didn't have people representing the other places where these issues also arise. You know, we learn about them ourselves, but that doesn't, because I read about what's happening in France, it doesn't make me suddenly an expert on France in the same way that a historian of France would be. So to have a conference like that, in which you take some of the themes that we were interested in, but also have people working on Western Europe, or people working in North America, or people working on, you know, Africa, Asia, what you name it, would be, to my mind, the next step. So to include ourselves in conferences that are thematic or that are explicitly dedicated to comparative or transnational or international history, that conference, in a sense, was a have your cake and eat it too conference, because we were able to think broadly and yet still anticipate that the people to whom we were speaking understood the basic geography, both political, economic, and physical, of the place, of the large part of the world that we're all interested in.
So just one last question. I was wondering, I guess you've touched on this theme in some different ways during the course of the interview, but I was just wondering what kind of advice you would offer to a young historian who's thinking about entering this field, or who has just, you know, started grad school, and what would you tell them in a kind of, if you could reach that broad audience of people, about the future of the field or what they should be thinking about?
So, yeah. If I suddenly had the ear of every first-year graduate student in a PhD program in history, the first thing I would say is you are much younger than you think you are, and if there is a language you wish you had started learning 8 years ago, but you think it's too late to learn it, just start right now. Stop listening to this interview and go register in a language class. Because before you know it, you will be 8 years older than you are right now. And if you start now, then at that future date, you will actually be able to use that language. So that is my number one piece of precious advice. As far as the future of the field, I guess... The way that I connect to people, one of the ways that I connect to people outside of East, who are not explicitly interested in East Central Europe, is by thinking about histories of economic life, right? So I'm not a real environmental historian, I'm not a real economic historian, but I am a historian who thinks that the environment is important, and I am a person who thinks that economic life is very important. So even though I'm not by any means cleometric in my approach, I do like to think about the ways that large economic structures and small economic transactions affect other parts of our lives. So cultural production, or the incentive for, not historians, but for people, for real people, to learn other languages, or the way we behave, or the way we get married, or the way that we have sex, or anything, right? And I think that that's not the right way for everybody. For someone else, it might be literature, or it might be the linguistic turn, or it might be high diplomacy. Who knows what it will be. But to think also methodologically about what ways about thinking, what drives humans to behave in the ways that they do, connect you to people outside your field. And, you know, think about, for me, at this point in my life, part of what I need to do is think about teaching classes in those other fields so that I can reach out to other students, to students who aren't necessarily interested in East Central Europe, but also on the job market, to understand how you are going to present yourself to a department as someone who's going to contribute to answering questions that are interesting to lots of people in the department. And I hope that that is a way for people to, for students of history, for students of East Central European history, to feel like what they are doing is relevant without feeling like it is not legitimate to study East Central European history, right? We can still be interested in this part of the world and write about this part of the world long after the Cold War, which was sort of a self-perpetuating justification for studying this part of the world as long as it lasted. We don't need to abandon it. We just need to think about participating in larger conversations.
Thank you so much for coming. This has been really great. I hope you can come back soon.
Thank you for having me, Holly.